In the aftermath of the IRA attempt in 1984 to kill the Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher by planting a bomb in the hotel she was using in Brighton, the IRA released a statement. It ended with the words, "You have to be lucky all the time. We only have to be lucky once." Terrorist bomb plots are clearly nothing new. One of the most famous of them happened on this night in 1605 back in the UK and is still remembered and its failure celebrated all these years later. Remember, remember the 5th of November, gunpowder, treason and plot. But pity cats and dogs and budgies on such a night, this very night, as what is known as Guy Fawkes Night, explodes in a cacophony of rockets, whiz-bangs and Catherine wheels, and shivering cats and trembling dogs cower under chairs, longing for it all to be over. I sometimes wonder what foreign visitors to the UK must make of it all, or newcomers, when they hear about the background story, the real story of Guy Fawkes, and watch the burning effigies and the remembering the 5th of November. Where was the gunpowder? Whose was the treason? What was the plot? And what did it mean? And isn't it a bit odd, after all these years, to make such a fuss about what was, in reality, a terrible event, involving would-be mass murder, religious intolerance, torture, execution and shame? The truth is that the background story is a pretty grim affair. Catholics, feeling under threat from the Protestant king to such a degree that they planned to blow up the royals, the lords and the government, and came within a whisker of achieving their aim. The conspirators were given away by one of their number who got squeamish about the fact that there could be collateral damage and innocent Catholics might be killed, so a warning was given. Enough of a leak to alert the authorities, and the plotters were caught in the very act of setting up their bomb factory. All very shocking and shameful and appalling, and you'd have to think a kind of strange set of motivations, actions and political intrigues to be commemorating with such gusto some 400 years later. Ironically, the issues that underlay the outrage are still with us. Questions of dealing with diversity, coping with prejudices, issues and extents of religious tolerance are very much to the fore in our 21st century world, indeed with an intensity and potential for disaster greater than I've ever experienced in my whole life. Veils or not veils, are they allowed? Faith schools and quarters, Shias and Sunnis at each other's throats, passions inflamed, angry mobs, theatres closed for showing offensive dramas, the BBC condemned for religious hurt that this programme or that have caused, crosses allowed to be worn or not worn at work, Christians kidnapped and killed, ethnic cleansing on religious grounds in Myanmar. Anyone who fails to see the powerful force that religion exerts across our world now, today, demonstrates a dangerous naivety. The potential for upheaval in the world, if we don't deal with the challenges of religious diversity, is incalculable. It's in the air, it's on the world's agenda with a vengeance. It will shape the destinies of my children and your children. So we need to think about it, find a way of understanding it and coping with it, this diversity. And we need to begin by acknowledging that there are real and deep differences between the religions of the world. Differences which have to be faced and appreciated. There might be superficial similarities that could deceive us into thinking that they were all coming from the same place and taking us to the same place. World religions have these common elements. They have sacred books. They have places of worship. They have revered leaders. They have ancient teachings. They have lifestyle choices. They have rituals and regulations. They have special days and sacred seasons. So it might look superficially like they're all at the same game, but they also have unbridgeable differences that are fundamental and huge. And it is folly to try to airbrush these out of the real picture. Actually, we're not all saying the same things about life, the universe and everything. We might wish we were, but it is not so. And only those who haven't bothered to look at the facts will allow themselves to persist in the myth, suggest to a devout Jew that really he believes the same as a Muslim and watch the temperature rise, tell a Hindu that their faith is no different really from that of a Christian and watch the look of incredulity cross his face, assure a Christian that their worldview and that of a Buddhist are pretty much the same, and see the eyes glaze over. However, if we can't deny the realities of that diversity, nor should we can perhaps embrace the differences and allow them to be in a spirit of respect and tolerance, in a generous, gracious spirit of debate, discussion and reason, from which arrogance and aggression are absent. As we know, historically, this has not been an easy approach to achieve. Instead, there has been suspicion, ignorance, aggression and disrespect, leading to just the kinds of outcomes that hang over the world with threat and danger. And the resort to violence, a la Guy Fawkes, has always been an option for those who want to break the religious logjam and establish their style of faith as the only option. They are, as we all know too well, people out there prepared to kill without compunction, willing to impose their religious viewpoint on others without mercy or conscience. There are still angry faces twisted in hate. And even back home in Scotland still, the Scottish nation has to contend with the issues raised by the raw, ugly sectarianism that still haunts aspects of our culture. The shibboleth question in the west of Scotland, "So what school did you go to?" Scottish people will know what that question means. But the bottom line missed so dramatically, completely and tragically, by Guy Fawkes and his cronies and his likes, and by all those who are willing to hurt in the name of religion, is this: the resort to violence of action or word in order to win the day for your viewpoint has no place in our modern Christ-informed Christianity. Sure, we recognise and admit that in the past this was not an insight always enjoyed, a distinction universally made. There were in the past confused motivations whereby it was thought people could legitimately, in the name of God, be threatened, bullied and cajoled into the kingdom. The dark legacy of the Crusades, for all the mixed motives of economics, superstition and conquest that lay within that cruelty, that dark legacy haunts the story of the church to this day, and remains a convenient rod with which her enemies can beat her. History has also plenty of evidence of internal battles fought with blood and fire that shamed the church. Ancient irrational hatreds, self-inflicted intellectual blindness that made the church ugly and tainted it with the ruthless abuse of power. Certainly we know, within the long story of Christendom, there can be found a ghastly catalogue of mistakes and atrocities, religious persecution on a grand scale, the inquisitions of various kinds, the Reformation, which has shaped the nature of the Church of Scotland, did not come to pass without pain, bloodshed and soaring arrogance, intolerance towards the losers. None of the Church's history happened in a vacuum, but in real time, in the real world, where real people could do really bad things in the name of something really good. That was then. This is now. It would be good to think that we've learned a thing or two from those bad old days. It would be good to think that we've begun to listen more closely to the words of Christ. Love your enemies. Pray for those who would harm you. We understand now, you would think, that violence, force of arms, intimidation, terror, oppression and sectarian prejudice have no place in the modern world and certainly not in the modern church. These dark instruments are no longer tools of the trade for the church of our times. We stand back from the excesses of the past and recognise them for the dreadful mistakes they were, and rightly so. But in a sense, we do a disservice to history if we bring our enlightened modern searchlight to bear full beam on the grubby doings of yesteryear and condemn their lack of insight. That was then. This is now. It would be good to think that we can see more clearly now, thank God. That we would know, we would just know that it was wrong to persecute, torture, burn and brutalise in the name of Christ. Of course we know that. The kinds of indiscriminate killings that happened in Scotland at the time of the Covenanters, the running battles in the streets between Catholics and Protestants that stained the pages of the nation's story, the foul sectarian chants from the football terraces, gunpowder plots and the like. We know now that we have no place in the 21st century church for such things, such thinking. And we're blessed in having that insight, that liberty from the chains of ignorance and caricature. Sure, we have our own issues and limitations, and we bring our own hesitations to the life of the church today. But it would be good to think we've learned something, that we can see now the appalling irony, the glaring contradictions that are inherent in the idea that violence, murder, carnage might be done in the name of religion, especially the religion of Jesus of Nazareth, the Prince of Peace, who would die rather than fight, who would suffer himself rather than hurt others, who washed feet, who turned the other cheek, who prayed for those who hurt him, who loved his enemies. To do violence against others in his name, in that name, above all names, is a denial and betrayal of everything he is about. It just doesn't fit. Nonetheless, just because we've grown accustomed to the slogan, love your enemies, pray for those who hurt you, that shouldn't lead us to lose the shattering impact of its radical message. The word of Christ is the complete and utter contradiction of the cynical self-regard that often seems to underpin the way the world works, where political expediency, power, corruption, ruthlessness, untruth and violence, these methods and means are all but legitimised as the cogs and wheels necessary to make the world go round. The ideal of love, Christ's love, is the antithesis of the ideologies of cynicism and power. The vulnerability that Christ embraced on the cross is the divine contradiction of how the world thinks you get things done, how the world gets its way. Certainly, as we survey the devastations and the anguish that litter the story of humanity and its lust for power, its willingness to do grievous harm to people in the name of truth or liberty or religion or nationhood, we do grow weary for another kind of truth, a way of dealing with difference and debate that doesn't require that our opponents be crushed, our critics mangled, opposing and contradictory voices silenced by force. So-called smart Christians who pride themselves on their intellectual superiority rather look down on the simple faith of those who make their way through life with their attitudes and thinking founded on the mantra, what would Jesus do? What would Jesus do? Now, we appreciate that sometimes amid the complexities and complications of a scientific postmodern age, it isn't always that simple to be quite sure what Jesus would do about stem cell research or face transplants or wind farms or AI. But we can absolutely be sure, we can be absolutely sure that he would not do this, hurting people, resorting to violence against those whose faith view is different from ours. And if that means suffering, if that looks like foolishness to the world, if that seems like weakness and the appearance of defeat, well, there he hangs, abandoned, crushed on the wheel of history, a broken man. You decide whether he did any good, made any difference. If his way seems folly and disaster, our faith is an Easter faith in an Easter Lord whose love triumphs over hate and quietly conquers the world without force or imposition or threat or bullying. He knocks on the door of the human heart, on the heart of every man and every woman, and waits to be invited in. What looks like weakness is real strength. What seems like folly is really glory. And walking with Jesus Christ, listening to the way he speaks and lives and deals with people, affects how we think, how we deal with the differences. Walking our walk with him shows us that his way is not the world's way. His way and following it means that we will never make the terrible, bloody mistakes of the past. And in that, we will be set free. In that, we will be blessed.